Tonight on Arena, Philip McMahon and Emer Dineen on This Is Pop Baby's Dublin Theatre Festival show. And in TV, we review Colin Farrell in The Penguin and Season 2 of Frasier. +51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena, and you can watch proceedings on rte.ie/arena. 0800 Cupid is This Is Pop Baby's newest offering since their smash hit Wake earlier this year. Written by Emer Dineen, directed by Philip McMahon, it's described as genre-defying, a cross between a narrative album, a musical and a personal existential journey steeped in cabaret energy. The journey is that of Anna, a London-based drag king who is in the middle of something of an existential crisis post-pandemic and searching for connection, but possibly in all the wrong places. Isn't that where we all look? Writer,
you're making me want to go and see this show, Sean.
There you go. Writer and drag king Emer Dineen, director Philip McMahon, who's going to go and see the show now, are both with me in studio. Philly, the meeting between you and Emer, I think, is quite an interesting one in terms, which I think wasn't really about this project, but it's certainly... was the seeds of this project were probably sown there.
It was right back to the first meeting that I could trace this project back to, which was in January 2020, and we all know what happened shortly after in 2020. I was auditioning actors for a musical that was happening in Manchester. The musical was called Insane Animals. And this woman walked into the room and had this quite distinct British accent when she was talking to everybody on the panel. And then when I started speaking to her, she started speaking to me in a Cork accent. And I kind of thought, is this woman mocking me? Like, I'm here in the UK and this actor is kind of talking to me in Irish accent. This feels a bit off. And I was like, is everything okay? And she said, I'm so sorry. I'm Irish. My parents are Irish. I was born in Ireland. And anytime I meet an Irish person, I just speak in a Cork accent. And so it has been since.
It's so uncool. It's the most uncool thing ever. I just can't help. I've trained myself now, but this impulse to, you know, with my family, with my cousins, with everyone, anyone who has an Irish accent, I'm just like, hi, how are you doing? Are you okay? It's tragic.
And it just switches like that.
Yeah.
Where and when and how did that all start? I said therapist like.
Well, I talk to my parents in an Irish accent a lot. My mum and my dad are both from Cork. They both have thick Cork accents. My dad has the kind of Cork accent where he runs all of his words together and he's so low you can't really tell like what he's saying, you know. He's kind of like one of those.
Don't bring the show to Cork.
So yeah, like when I was a kid, we'd oscillate all the time, me and my brother, kind of like it was very fluid going in between, like, you know, because we'd spend the summers in Cork as well. So we come back like, hi, how are you doing? And then like, and then all of a sudden be super Cockney. So
but what's interesting about that is that, you know, you were learning this shift in identity.
Yeah.
From a very, whether you were conscious of learning a shift in identity or not, I don't know. Do you think that has fed into your being a performer?
Oh, wow. That's a very interesting question. I don't know. I think there are things, you know, innate in Irish culture that I draw upon in, like, my work. Like, my mum's a Shanachie. She's a storyteller of Celtic mythology. And my dad was an actor and, you know, storytelling and performance and making sense of the world through stories is obviously a very kind of innately Irish thing. And I can't say how much, you know, whether it's in the performance of identity, because both of those, both, you know, holding both identities, they do feel authentic to me. It doesn't feel performative necessarily.
Yeah.
But I've definitely, gotten a flair for storytelling from my Irish roots.
And it's also there, I suppose, straightforwardly in your performance work in that you are Emer, but there is also a drag king version of Emer.
I don't know what you're talking about. Yes, yeah. I have a few characters. My drag king is Duncan Disorderly, a.k.a. Double D.
He was in Wake. Very, very busy in Wake.
He was very busy in Wake, yes. Very busy DJ, major celebrity DJ superstar in Wake. And yeah, he's one of a few kind of cabaret characters that I oscillate in and out of.
All right. So the story you're telling then in 0800 Cupid is the story of Anna, who has nothing got to do with Aimer Dineen.
Absolutely nothing to do with me. No, it's very, very thinly veiled. Yeah, it's a very, very true story and about a kind of roller coaster of events that happened to me over a couple of months in my life.
Yeah, very, very kind of post, during and mostly post pandemic. Would that be fair?
Post pandemic, yeah, kind of.
What has happened during pandemic that kind of, I think, led to a bundle of things occurring in your life post pandemic?
I can't say that. I can't really trace it back to anything being consequential or any kind of like one linear line. It's just, you know. As with most people, you kind of had a lot of time to sit and think and analyze and ask a lot of kind of existential questions about, you know, existence and life. And yeah, I can't say that really throughout the pandemic, it hugely informed it all was like a kind of catalyst, but definitely in terms of kind of where I was at and looking for meaning and metaphors and trying to understand and kind of grapple with things a lot more. I was a lot more open coming out of the pandemic.
Oh, that's it. So you actually, the period of introspection in some ways allowed you then to open out.
Yeah, I'd say so.
Can you give me a sense of some of the, because you did have a tough couple of years, it has to be said.
It's a bit of a rollercoaster, yeah.
What kind of things happened?
So, at the beginning of 2022, I was diagnosed with adult onset tic disorder, which is Tourette's, basically, is what I say in short form. But when you can't really get diagnosed with Tourette's as an adult, in order to be diagnosed with Tourette's, you have to be like under 18. So in adults, it's adult onset tic disorder. So out of nowhere, my body started moving without my permission. I was snapping my neck to the right and also my arm, my elbow, and I had involuntary kind of, I was making kind of involuntary sounds. And there's a line in the show and a kind of line that I use, which is like, it felt like driving a car for 26 years and all of a sudden the car decides to just do a wheelie or swerve off the road. Yeah. And it's kind of like, it's very, yeah, you feel... And when you no longer have control of your body or you feel disembodied, that kind of, definitely fed into, once again, kind of looking for ways in which I could ground myself in reality.
And I think there were other events within your family that were difficult to handle as well.
Yeah, yeah. There was, you know, there was a maelstrom of things. Mm. And I was looking for clues.
Were you looking for the why or just or just a way of explaining it?
I think so.
Yeah, a way of explaining it.
I think, well, I mean, certainly what I'm finding with this process as well, like trying to dramaturgically understand these things and trying to make life itself comprehensible or like, you know, come at it from an artistic angle or a narrative angle is also a challenge because life itself is hard to pin down.
Well, I guess that's why you have the outside eyes of people. Philly,
the forensic, gorgeous, piercing blue outside eyes. And Philly McMahon.
I mean, you can hear from Aimer, who's sitting here with us, obviously, the kind of level of energy that is there in you, and I presume that's all there in the performance as well. But in behind that, there is this kind of disquieting story that's ruffling things up a little bit. I guess that's where the drama lies when it comes to making a show, Philly.
Absolutely, and like Aimer, as you can hear, is so thoughtful and incisive and analytical, but it's also a showgirl, right? And has this, like, is a house music vocalist, is a playwright, is a drag king. And so you meet somebody that has all of this story and all of this skill set, and you think, right, there is a show there. There's a fabulous show there. And it is my job and the team's job and with Aimer to kind of go, how do you bring all of these elements in? Which is why it's so attractive to This Is Pop Baby, right? Because there's kind of, it screams This Is Pop Baby. But how do you actually make this into a kind of narrative hour 20 for an audience. So that's been the kind of really fun Rubik's Cube part of the process.
An hour 20, is it 12 new songs?
It is a play within an album, I would say. And there are kind of, 12 songs, musical motifs, you know. No bother to us and the audience, yeah. I promise.
Now, we haven't even mentioned 0800 Cupid yet. So we've had Emer. Anna is the character in the play. Thinly disguised version of yourself, Emer.
Very
I think
thin,
you've
yeah.
admitted there. So explain who Cupid is and what Cupid can do, perhaps that Anna can't.
Well, Cupid is your original wingman. Your chubby little boy in the sky who's going to make everything better, get everyone hitched, make everyone feel happy and connected. It was based on a real drag character that I had made coming out of lockdown that was going to be a camp catalyst for reconnection. And I was kind of doing the club circuit in London and I was like, this idea is going to have really help. Because I was like, I and everyone, but mostly me, felt kind of, disconnected and socially anxious and trying to figure out like what life was coming out of, the forest of several lockdowns and a lot of information, a lot of misinformation, a lot of time spent online. And it was just kind of like, you know what, we all just need to be here in the now, in the liveness of cabaret or in the liveness of theatre. And we need to connect and feel alive, And I thought this dressing up like a cherub was a very, very,
a good way to do that.
Healthy and balanced way of dealing with it, yeah.
A camp catalyst for reconnection is probably the best byline I've heard or kind of tagline I've heard in a long time. But you're touching there, Emer, on the fact that we all needed our social media during lockdown. It was how we communicated with the outside world. We all needed our Zoom calls and our, remote theatre shows that we were watching online. But at what point did you start to think, yes, we needed those and they were useful, but it wasn't the type of connection you were looking for. When did that start to become clear to you?
Well, I don't know if that's something that was just specific to lockdown. I think there's always an element of artifice in the connection that you have online. And like, as someone who's kind of grown up predominantly with the internet, never before in history have you had, a platform where you can curate yourself, or you have so many kind of like metrics or ways in which you can analyze, dissect, portray a version of yourself, amplify different versions of yourself and consistently compare yourself to others, or like it's kind of hemorrhaging the self-esteem of a lot of young people, as well as doing all these incredible things for social movements, for equality, for just getting people together, for organizing events. Like, of course there's it's not all bad at all, but I think all of those things were really compounded in lockdown because it was all we had. And so there's a disconnection from the self. I think if you're there are kids as young as like 10 curating a version of themselves that's going to be palatable for the internet, and then you're
feeling the pressure to do that.
Feeling the pressure to do that, and then like you're kind of showing who you are before you've even decided who you are yet, and that's really going to cause some kind of internal friction, I think.
A lot more problematic than having a Cork accent when you're speaking to Irish people.
Go away.
But as Emer describes it to us there, Philly, there is a very serious side to that. But you're not, this isn't a critique saying all social media is bad, let's get rid of it immediately. It's more nuanced than that, I think, is what you're looking
for. Yeah, no, it's actually just one thread in the piece. I think what's really interesting and part of the kind of, Emer and I are very different generations. So working with somebody who is an artist in their 20s, you beam into this whole other world. And I think what we don't see on our theatre stages a lot is people in their 20s getting to tell their story at this length, right? And so it's a really kind of interesting way to kind of hear what's going on for a younger generation. And I think that, to make the case for a live performance versus the internet or whatever, you know. Yeah. I think it's going to become increasingly important that we convince young people specifically to come into live spaces, to put down the phones and to kind of see the world through somebody else's eyes. Now, it can't be through Emer's eyes because the tickets are actually, we've just learned, are now sold out to this show.
When is the rerun happening, you know?
Well, the show is we are transferring to London straight after. So, and then, you know, you'll have listeners in London, so come and see us in London.
Yeah. Well, I mean, amazing that it is sold out at this point. But this is Pop Baby. Let's face it, have a fairly extraordinary reputation. The excitement of This Is Pop Baby taking this story, Emer, and helping you to tell it in the way that it's been told here through music produced by Elaine May. I mean, electric dance music queen for sure in this country, and Tom Beach, the musical director here. What did that mean to you, or what does it mean for you?
It's just so exciting. They're both such incredibly talented people, but also so receptive to adapting the art form to complement the story as well, you know, because, you know, musicians, you kind of create things in the context of an album or a single or something like that. But in this, we kind of really had to ask, we had to work collaboratively, and Elaine and Tom, you know, they've been so sensitive to the story, and they've really brought their artistry full force and not only created, you know, and helped me create these kind of incredible tracks that, you know, support the lyrics, that support the narrative. They also kind of like bring the whole thing together in a really cohesive, exciting way.
Yeah, and the other thing, I mean, I'm wondering too, you know, because I understand you're being careful not to say my story and then I'm going to, you know, blurt out all of my story on the airwaves tonight. You're being careful about what you want to say, but you do have to go to personally difficult places in this show. Yeah. Striking that balance between Emer Dineen, performer, and performing the character of Anna, and telling Emer Dineen's very thinly veiled story through that character. How difficult is it to strike that balance?
Yeah, I mean, what's interesting is that, like, I kind of set out with this very meta, kind of very general idea about, you know, love and connection in the modern day. And through working with Philly over, you know, many years, and a lot of, you know, these things kind of happening and evolving whilst I was trying to do something, you know, a lot less connected to me, it all started to just filter into my life, and it became like, oh, you can't tell a macro story without making it personal. Mm-hmm. And I care too much about this and this message to not, you know, just be honest. And like, it's funny that you bring up Anna, because Anna's actually kind of just like a tool we've really been using in rehearsal. And what I'm beginning to understand now through rehearsal and through the piece is that I kind of just have to come out and say, take that very, very thin veil off and be like, hi, this is...
Are the programmes with the cast list printed yet?
We've just lost €30, yeah, with this change.
Very minor change, yeah. But it's a lot. Like, I can't lie, it's a lot. But I think there's for me at least, there's, like, people are looking for honesty. Like, there's so much misinformation. There's so, you know, there's a kind of drawing from truth because everything is so noisy and there's so much information everywhere, and, you know, it's hard to know what to believe, who to believe, where to put your beliefs. And I've always taken a lot of solace in and actually over lockdown I was listening to a podcast called The Moth, which is a great podcast. Yeah. If anyone's interested in hearing real life stories from people, real life events,
and very famous short stories
of people just being like, hey, this just happened to me, and this is how I dealt with it, and this is how I kind of look at life in response to that. And yeah, and obviously my mum as well, you know, being a Shanaki and kind of making sense of the world through stories as well. And kind of, we're just doing that. We're just adding a wig and some high heels and
a bit of glitter
and hoping for the best.
But it's still your story. And thanks so much for sharing it. And I can feel the honesty coming off you.
Yeah,
I'm sure it is there within the show as well. So the Dublin run of 0800 Cupid sold out, as we've been told, well in advance of the opening. It will transfer immediately to the Soho Theatre in London, where it will run from the 16th through to the 20th of October. And I sincerely hope we'll come back to this neck of the woods at some point in the future. Imogen Ian, Philly McMahon, thanks so much for being in with us this evening.
Thank you.
And so to our TV slot, we're reviewing the latest Batman spin-off on Sky Atlantic. The Penguin stars a barely recognisable Colin Farrell as the titular Penguin, the Gotham City crime lord. And this is a TV follow-up to Matt Reeves' 2022 superhero film, The Batman. Also starring Michael Zegan, who's in this, and Deirdre O'Donnell and Mark Strong. And last year's Fraser reboot returns to Paramount for a second season. Kelsey Grammer is back as the fastidious Dr. Fraser Crane, who at this stage has swapped his radio studio in Seattle for Harvard and Boston, or kind of gone back to there, really. He's also reacquainted with his old college friend from Oxford, Professor Alan Cornwell, played by Nicholas Lyndhurst. With me in studio, Jen Gannon and Chris Wasser, who've watched both series for us. We'll start with The Penguin, another offering from the DC comic universe, a big starring role for Colin Farrell. And you think, oh yeah, DC comic universe, we're into Batman, Cape Crusader stuff and all of that. You couldn't be further from the truth in some ways, Jen.
In a lot of ways. I mean, I think, you know, with the way that things have been going with comic book films, like, let's say, since Christopher Nolan's suite of The Dark Knight Rises and all of those films, it is a way of comic book being taken more seriously. So when you have someone like Christopher Nolan, he's basing, you know, his films on Michael Mann's Heat or Kubrick's Clockwork Orange, so there's that injection into it. And Matt Reeves' The Batman was kind of similar in the way of it's very dark, it's very angsty, and then you have something like Todd Phillips' Joker, and we're getting the second one soon with Lady Gaga. That was like kind of based on Martin Scorsese's King of Comedy. So all of these, like especially the Batman universe, they're all very serious films, like they're all to be taken very seriously, and this is kind of the same for TV. So with this, like, the Penguin is a gangster, but he is a gangster in the style that we have seen in the early 2000s. He is, you know, basically Tony Soprano. This is like a golden age of television story pushed through the lens of a comic book
villain. A superhero or supervillain type of story. As I said, Chris, Colin Farrell, I was watching the first 20 minutes, I was, is it him? Is it him? I kept asking myself. Describe the character and just how unrecognisable he is.
He's barely recognisable. He does something every now and then with his eyes, or there might be a little bit of a movement, and you'll think, there he is, under the prosthetics, under the makeup and the fat suit. But he is barely recognisable. He's playing Oswald Cobb. In the comics, it's Oswald Cobblepot. But again, we're taking things seriously. Cobblepot sounds a bit too seriously. It's Cobb. Or it sounds a bit too jokey. But it's Cobb in this series. He was a glorified street soldier, basically, for a guy named Carmine Falcone, who in Matt Reeves' The Batman was killed. And also in Matt Reeves' The Batman, we're not spoiling anything here because this is all explained at the beginning of the series. You had a guy named the Riddler, obviously, you know, one of Batman's trickiest foes, who set off a lot of bombs around Gotham, nearly flooded the city, and as a result, the place is in bits. So the Penguin is looking out at all of this, and he's called the Penguin because he's quite disfigured and he has a limp caused by an untreated club foot, and all the other gangsters call him this. He sees that there's a bit of a power vacuum, and also that, you know, the drugs that were being supplied before, they've all disappeared. They've all disappeared because of what the Riddler was at. And he thinks that he can get in there and he can rule the criminal underworld. And to do that, and it gets a little bit murky, he actually initiates a gang war between the Falcones and also the Maronis. Yeah. And the Maronis' boss is behind bars. So it's a little bit tricky. He's kind of going from prisons to mansions, initiating this war. And he also kind of comes up against the daughter of Carmine Falcone. Her name is Sophia. She's played by Christy Milioti. And he does not expect to form an alliance with her. And also, I should say, despite the fact that he's a forming falling in lines with her. He might have done something to her brother, and he really doesn't want her to find out about it.
To know that. Okay, let's have a listen to Colin Farrell as the Penguin. At this stage, quite close to the beginning, he's broken into Carmine Falcone's old place, and he's kind of looking to rob the safe, effectively. But he's interrupted by Falcone's son, Alberto, played by Michael Sagan. A bit of language in the midst of this clip, so be warned on that.
I see you've made yourself at home.
Hey, Alberto, you're here. Good. Saves me a trip.
What the fuck are you talking about?
These jewels belong to you. Your dad made that clear. But some of the guys, well, you know, they're goddamn scavengers. So I thought I'd do you a solid. As a show of support for your new position. Well, congratulations. I only wish it had been under different circumstances. Now, Carmine, he was a great man. You got some big shoes to fill. not too big. I mean, you know, manageable shows.
You think I'm an idiot? You greedy prick? My father's been dead a week.
Hey, Al. You all right? Because we keep a stash in the loft if you want a hit.
That's not why I'm here.
Of course not. I mean, I was only saying...
You don't get it. Everyone's looking at me now. I got this deal going.
Colin Farrell and Michael Sagan there in a scene from The Penguin. And we do really get a sense from that, Jen Gannon, just how dark this is. This is not cartoon. This is not kind of wild comic book stuff.
No, this is not like that colourful kind of what you'd expect, like the oversized
and it even
caricature.
Looks dark. Mm.
It's very dark. It has the look of like, it's Craig Zobel who did Mayor of Easttown is directing the first three episodes at least. And that the Gotham here is, you know, it's very dour. It's very, it's bleak and it's gritty looking.
Even like bleaker the than Christopher Nolan's Gotham.
Scene. Exactly. Oh, yeah. And more kind of, it wants it to be more realistic even in another way than Nolan's had this kind of sheen from it that was like kind of another space, whereas this, they want it to be very real and grounded in another way. I mean, and I think, look, for all the bells and whistles that Colin Farrell has attached to his face, like, it doesn't detract from his performance, because you do think it could, which is the opposite effect that I guess they wanted from that, because they want you for him to be lost. They don't want you to see Colin Farrell, the matinee idol. They want you to see something else, something different, I guess. It's a very 90s solution to a problem where they'd have like Brad Pitt or Johnny Depp and they'd be like, oh God, can you not? We want to uglify them, quote unquote.
Did he need all of that? I mean, because the performance is phenomenal.
That's what I was just going to say. The performance is so good. He's such an accomplished actor, obviously, as we know, but like he gives him this sense of desperation and this pathos to him where he is this kind of dumb schmuck that everybody else is kind of, you know, taking the mick out of and abusing in certain ways, and he has these massive flashes of rage because of this, but then he also has this lightness of touch, these eccentricities and quirkiness to him that someone like Colin Farrell is so good at and so good at dialing into, and especially with the scenes where he takes on this kind of driver from who's orphaned called Victor, and the scenes between the two of them tap into something very different, an emotional register that
there are loads of scenes
it's very promising
that I watched. There were two-handers, you know, it isn't a big comic book world either, just these two-hander scenes, quite intense emotionally. What about the female characters here in particular? Jen has already mentioned Christina Milioti's Sophia and Deirdre O'Donnell's, plays the Penguin's mother.
Yeah, Christina Milioti, her performance as Sophia is quite terrifying in places, and she gives as good as she gets because, again, like what Jen was saying, there's an awful lot of prosthetics and makeup doing the heavy lifting, but Colin Farrell is giving a wonderful performance there, and he's touching at, you know, on the heartache behind the villain, and he gives a very human performance. And so it's up to kind of Christina Milioti to kind of match that, and she really does. You get this feeling from her that she's so sick of being pushed around by her brothers and her uncles and her late father, and she feels that it's really her time, but everyone just sees her as this, you know, she's actually playing a villain from the comic books called the Hangman, who's done time in Arkham Asylum. She wants to be taken seriously. She wants him to know that she can be the one in charge. And then you have Deirdre O'Connell playing Frances Cobb, who is the Penguin's mother, and she has clearly had an awful time of it. You know, she's quite mentally unwell, and the Penguin is actually visiting her secretly. He tells the other guys that his mother's dead, but he's visiting her.
Yeah,
You know, he's stocking up the fridge, he's dancing with her, and they have such a lovely, such a weird, twisted relationship at times. But there are these lovely moments between the characters where you're thinking to yourself, we're not in the Marvel Cinematic Universe here, we're definitely in DC world. But I mentioned Marvel, Sean, because it does have... And when you're watching Marvel TV series, basically, you're always kind of thinking to yourself, right, we're watching some of the small town heroes here go to war against the big bads. But you're always thinking, but why can't the Avengers just step in? With DC stuff, whenever they have TV series, you're always thinking, where are the superheroes? So it has a Batman problem. Why is nobody talking about Batman? This is actually set a week after Matt Reeves' The Batman.
Do you need to have seen the Matt Reeves?
You don't, because it explains everything in the first two or three minutes. But it is quite odd that none of the characters are talking about what happened in the film.
Do we? Are you going to watch to the end? You probably may have already seen all the episodes. And are you looking forward to a possible season two, Jen?
I don't. I mean, I think it's heavily indebted to a lot of previous like gangster films. It's a lot of, you know, references to Goodfellas, even, you know, within the first episode. And it's not very knowing about it. It actually feels a bit lackluster to do that. It is this very simplistic gangster story that we have seen a lot before. And for me, I think ultimately when you've had a character as deeply complex and complicated and complete as Tony Soprano, do we need a kind of comic book version of Tony Soprano? I don't think so. Like, I don't want to see Harvey Dent repurposed as an ad exec on Madison Avenue. I don't want his version of Mad Men.
Stars.
I would give it a 3, because I want, sometimes I just want comic books to be comic books and not to be something else.
Okay, you'd like you'd,
but I think Colin Farrell is to be commended, like a great performance.
Stars from you.
I think if David Chase and Martin Scorsese come together to make a comic book series, it might have looked a little bit like this. And I think Colin Farrell, again, like what Jen was saying, he almost makes us root for a terrible man here. That's how good his performance is. So I'll stick with a 3.5 out of 5.
Alright, let's move on to our second offering this evening. Their second season of Frasier, this is Paramount Plus, Kelsey Grammer, of course. This has been dubbed the third act in the life of the eccentric psychiatrist that we first met in Boston in the hit series Cheers. Then he took up a job in radio, stationed in Seattle to be near his family. And that was Frasier. And now Frasier has come full circle and returned to Boston to be near his own son, Freddie. Did anybody never hear of Fawlty Towers? You make a number of episodes and you stop. Yeah.
That's it. Stop while the going is good. And we should remember as well, Frasier had one of the most wonderful endings in TV sitcom history. You know, he actually went for, you know, his one true love over, you know, the show position in San Francisco. He chased Charlotte, played by Laura Linney. And you thought to yourself, he's gone. He's walked off into the sunset. This is a great moment for Frasier. In the first season of the revival, we learned, well, that marriage has ended and he's kind of, you know, he's left his work in Chicago and he's back to the place where everybody used to know his name. And you're thinking to yourself, why, you know, rolling towards 70, why is Frasier still kind of, you know, bumping into furniture, doing silly things? And why is he back to the very beginning? This is supposed to be a third act for him, but it just feels like a rehash of the first act.
Okay, and Kelsey Grammer, obviously, you might ask, why is Kelsey Grammer doing this? Because everybody, with John Mahoney, obviously can't be there for, you know, he's no longer with us. But the other actors, they're roaring in their absence, aren't they?
Yeah, because I think like it was critically acclaimed, Frasier.
Yeah.
And you don't get something that is beloved by viewers and critically acclaimed. It usually doesn't work like that. It's usually one or the other. And it was so clever. The writing was genius. It was always farce, but it was farce brought to this heightened level where you didn't know where the rug was going to be pulled out from under you by the end of it. And the laziness of this writing is actually frightening to me when I watched like this season. I mean, the new episode Ham, where Frasier and the other professor Alan, they fall out before they can eat some expensive imported ham. It sounds like something from The King of Queens. It does not sound like something from Frasier.
Let's have a listen to just ahead of that row. We have Professor Alan Cornwell played by Frasier played by Kelsey Grammer and Professor Alan Cornwell played by Nicholas Lyndhurst. And here they are, and there's a waiter comes in the middle of it. Eve played by Jess Salguero.
I can't believe he gets here tomorrow. Where does the time go?
Seems like only yesterday. They sent us a picture of our little guy frolicking in the Spanish Highlands.
Aw, did you guys sponsor a kid?
Sort of. We bought a ham.
Not just any ham. An 18-pound acorn-fed jamón ibérico from España.
Cost as much as a laptop.
Cool use of money. Last summer, I vacationed in Hartford. So, what's the occasion?
Excellent question. You see, When Alan and I attended Oxford together, we sojourned in Spain and enjoyed the most exquisite meal.
Ever since, we've been trying to recreate that Epicurean perfection.
So, in order to celebrate 40 years of friendship...
Wait, is the story just starting? Yeah, no, I have other tables.
Well, I hope you'll join us for Ham Day.
Oh, I'd love to join you guys. Ooh, I'll whip up some of my famous sangria.
Ooh, sangria. You know, perhaps we could also pair our delicacy with some cotton candy and Rice Krispie treats.
Staggering blow, Fraser. Well done.
Thank you.
Yeah, we knew it was a staggering blow before you told us. That was Kelsey Grammer and Alan Corbell, Pevin Nicholas Lyndhurst. But Kelsey Grammer, he could recite the phone book and he'd time it to get a laugh.
I mean, he's as garrulous as ever, as, you know, he is, you know, this vainglorious windbag, and it is a delight to have him still be like that. But at the same time, you're missing, there are gaping holes there in the cast where you don't have somebody like David Hyde-Pierce, who was
Niles,
the younger brother. And they're that twosome, that snobbish infighting and ridiculousness that they had together was just a thing of joy. And then even someone like Jane Leaves, like her turn as a very eccentric, like Daphne Moon, you don't have that. Obviously, as we said, like, we don't. Marty Crane is one of the great sitcom characters, and he was the heart of Frasier. And to not have John Mahoney, and to feel like you're doing this poor facsimile then with a generational skip where you have, you know, Frasier's son Freddie, who is now a firefighter, trying to echo like Marty being an ex-cop. It doesn't work because Freddie is not a three-dimensional character. He's very bland and forgettable, and it just feels like they're always trying to chase something that already was so perfect. Why would they bother?
Is there anything to save this? Maybe the ensemble acting?
Not really, no, because it makes
the writing.
Absolutely not, no, because look, Kelsey Grammer has lost none of his enthusiasm, but as I was saying, you're only as good as the material on the page, and the material on the page here is not good enough. And it is quite upsetting at times to see Nicholas Lyndhurst and Kelsey Grammer, these two sitcom giants, just kind of, you know, losing their way. I think it's out of ideas. Look, the initial setup where, you know, Fraser is the dad and his son is the college dropout.
There's something in that.
There's something there. Yeah. You could have had something special out of it, but it just resembles, you know, at times, you know, Jen mentioned A King of Queens. It reminded me of How I Met Your Mother, and that is not a good comparison.
All right, stars.
It's look two. I mean, I think it's impossible to fully hate Fraser, but it is, but
Kelsey
it's possible,
Grammer.
But it's still, it ruined my week. You know, seeing
ruined
Fraser,
your week.
Yeah, like this.
Would you give him two stars to Kelsey Grammer? Fraser.
Two. Yeah, one for Kelsey Grammer and one for Andrews Keith, who plays Niles' son David, because I actually feel like he does this eerie impression of Niles. So at sometimes you kind of think they're back together again.
Oh,
but
okay,
just take the box set out, stream it, do something, do yourself a favor, Fraser again.
Okay, The Penguin, Jen Gannon and Chris Watter there telling us about The Penguin, which can be streamed on Sky Atlantic, and now from Friday, season two of Fraser will be available on Paramount Plus from tomorrow. Chris Watter and Jen Gannon with us this evening. Clifton Arts Festival is the longest running community arts festival in Ireland. Nobel laureate Kazuo Ishiguro described it as Ireland's best kept secret. Well, I'm not so sure that it's that guarded a secret as it heads into its 47th year. Festival runs from today through until the 29th of September, when the County Galway town will be alive with all kinds of arts events, from concerts to aerial spectacle, visual arts in many forms. One of the performers at this year's event is renowned fiddler Jerry Harrington, who's originally from Kenmare, but latterly of County Roscommon. I'm delighted that Jerry is in our Sligo studio, and I want to hear the fiddle straight away, Jerry, if that's okay. You're going to play a reel by Paddy Fahey, who wrote a lot of tunes in his day, and this one's simply called Paddy Fahey's.
Thank you, Sean. Thank you.
Absolutely beautiful. Paddy Fahey's, or one of Paddy Fahey's several tunes, are real there.
I don't know which number it is, Sean, because if Paddy named all his tunes, nobody would know he recorded it or he composed it. So he thought, like, I'll put Paddy Fahey in 72 tunes.
There you go. Well, whatever it number it is, and whatever Paddy called it in his head, I was delighted to hear it played by you this evening, Gerry.
Thank you, Sean. You know,
also kind of astonished, because when I hear the name Gerry Harrington, I think of the fiddle. When I hear you playing like that, it sounds as if you started playing it at the age of 1.5, and that it had been in your arms, in the womb. You're so attached to the instrument and so much a part of you. Yet it wasn't your first instrument.
No, I was adopted when I was young, and my parents really didn't gravitate towards music. They thought, like, I'd be heading down a slippery slope of life, as it were. So, but I used to whistle myself to school every day. And I remember when I was really small, I used to sing myself to sleep. So I never knew where this kind of talent for music came.
Yeah.
Until I met my mother when I was 40 years old. And she was a great dancer, and she was full of fun and a great singer. So it came through that line.
It was in the genes. And I think you started on the mandolin, or certainly mandolin was there for a period of time, as well as the whistling and the singing on the way to school. But then the fiddle caught your eye, or caught your ear. Was there a big eureka moment, Gerry, or was it a slow burn and you were slowly drawn in?
Well, I always loved the fiddle, but in the area I grew up, there weren't many fiddle players, and my art teacher in school at the time, Joe Thoma, who introduced me to the fiddle basically, and was a great influence on me in my early years. I just loved listening to classical violin as well on the radio when I was young. You know, I don't know why, I can't explain that, but I just love the violin because it's such an expressive instrument, and it can be played in any music, in any genre, you know.
And have you played across genres yourself? I know that you spent time, didn't you, when you went off to America, maybe was there a bit of jazz in this on the scene at
no,
that point?
No, I played old-timey music. I went down to the Appalachian Mountains with a friend of mine on a road trip that was supposed to be 3 weeks, and it was actually 3 months. So I met a lot of great musicians from the Appalachian Mountains, Tommy Gerard and all those people at that time. And I played that music, and I also played French Acadian music. But when I came back to Ireland, I thought, oh my God, our well is so big. Let's put all my interest into Irish traditional music.
You dipped the bucket into that particular well.
Exactly.
You had as a young fella as well, I think, seen Seamus Cray, Jackie Daly at the Mills Bar in Ballyvourney.
Yeah.
And you subsequently then travelled around with Seamus. To what extent were you learning as you travelled with him?
Well, you see, learning back in the day was a kind of a social thing. You were around the musicians. You picked it up on your own. You didn't really get any classes, and you know, they could be grumpy or something, you know. So I was around it. I was blessed with a good year to learn music, because I read music, but I'd be very slow at it, you know. So I used to travel with Seamus, and I used to meet Jackie Daly. Was also very, very good to me, and he was very inspiring to me, you know. And
were you kind of playing on the QT after the gigs, or how, you know, were you asking them to listen, or were you just watching and then going off quietly and learning?
I was just watching, going off quietly and coming back, because back in the day it was kind of serious. If you were out of tune or didn't play the rhythm right, you could be told to leave. That doesn't happen today so much, you know.
And did you pluck up the courage then eventually to kind of sit down and play with those great masters?
Oh, I did, and played with those great masters right off, you know, until they. Seamus has passed away now, but Jackie's still alive and well and playing wonderful music.
And the way you know, having kind of watched and learned from them and gone off quietly and learned the tunes yourself, or got them to a point where you felt you could sit down and at least play alongside them, how has that fed into how you were? You're a tutor now for the fiddle yourself. How has that fed into the way you teach?
Well, I suppose I teach the way I learnt, I suppose, you know. I teach all the little things and
It took me a long time. It takes a long time to be a good teacher, as you know. Yeah. You know, because you can't be a good player and a good teacher. They're different things, you know.
Yeah. Some say it's easy to teach. I would argue that it's nearly harder, and particularly if you're a good player, it can be hard.
It can be, because, you know, you have to be into the kind of psychology and to get into the person, how they think and how they work, because everybody's different in the teaching, you know, that you're teaching. They have different attributes, different things. And so it's to work on the weaker points all the time, you know?
Yeah. Now, you have a second tune for us. This is one of your own airs. Lovely story behind how this air came into being, Jerry.
Yeah. I had a great friend in... I knew since I was 9 years old. He would have been a cousin of my adopted family. Tom Martha was his name. And Tom used to go on some of the tours in America, and he used to sell CDs. He was such a character. He knew everything about New York City, absolutely everything. And we were great friends. And he just passed away suddenly when he was 50 years old. That's maybe 20 years ago now. And I wrote an air for his mom and sent it to her, because that was my way of, you know...
expressing sympathy.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, rather than sending a card or a written message.
Yeah, yeah.
What a wonderful way to do it, to say it with a tune.
Well, I think music is very powerful in that way, you know.
And is it simply called Tom Arthur or what?
No, I call it A Lament for My Friend.
A Lament for My Friend.
Yeah.
Let's have a listen. Thanks.
Okay, Sean, thank you.
Lament for My Friend, played there by Jerry Harrington in our Sligo studio. Thank you so much for that, Jerry. And I know you're playing alongside Peter Brown at the gig. So that fiddle style playing there and Peter Brown's piping should make for a gorgeous evening. Thanks for sharing your music with us this evening, Jerry.
We're great friends, Peter and myself, for quite a long time. And I'm delighted to be playing with him.
Well, the 47th Clifton Arts Festival starts today and it runs through until the 29th. Jerry will be performing at the Station House Hotel on Sunday, the 29th of September, with Peter Brown. You can find out full information about that and everything happening at the festival on cliftonartsfestival.ie. And that is our lot for this Wednesday evening. Paula Shields and Leah Murphy researched. Ollie Hamilton was the broadcast coordinator. Tommy O'Sullivan was on sound here in Dublin and helping us with that sound in Sligo. And thank you very much for it, was Marty Curran in our Sligo studio. Tonight's programme was produced by Pauline McNamara. Back with you tomorrow night, 7 o'clock here on RT Radio 1. John Creedon will be with you after the break.